Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
Hello.
Cole Hernaday.
Hey there.
And Nicole Lamb.
Hi.
And today we are talking with Brian Cronin. He's a writer at comicbookresources.com, and he has a new book coming out called 100 Things X-Men Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Welcome, Brian.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. And so my first question to you is, what initially brought you to the X-Men? Why the X-Men?
You mean as a reader?
Well, as a, yeah, as a fan, as a reader.
Well, I think I was writing a book. What's funny about the X-Men is that what era you come to the X-Men is so much defines what kind of X-Men fan you are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because if you started in the 80s, like when they were just getting to become the most popular, they were still the outcast team.
Right. And that's me.
By the time I was reading them in the early 90s, they were like the most popular thing in all of comics.
Mm-hmm. And that's my time.
So it's a whole other angle.
It's kind of like, who's your doctor?
Right.
You know what? Because I was explaining that to a friend of mine the other day who's never watched Doctor Who. And she said, where do I start? And I just kind of like took a deep breath and said, look at it this way. Everybody has their own doctor according to where they were when they discovered the show and their age. And, you know, I'm the first example you mentioned of the X-Men era. I was I picked up the all new Uncanny, and I want to say I was 13 or 14. I can even tell you what issue it was. It was number 111.
That's you know the exact issue?
Oh, yeah. It was my jam. I loved that comic book to death. Well, I only read like two or three at the time.
Brian, do you know your very first issue of the X-Men you ever read?
Yeah, it was right at the end of Claremont's run. And what I love about this issue is that if you did not know the characters back and forth, there's no way you're knowing the X-Men at that
point. Right.
Like, if no one gave you a clue, how in the world would you ever know what Forge's powers were?
Right. So, secondly, so what drew you to write the book? Why do you think the fans have 100 things they need to know? Why? What prompted you to do that?
Well, Triumph had done other, you know, my friend Mark had just wrote 100 things about Spider-Man last year. So that was really a really cool book. And so that's how I got in with them as well. And this is sounds like something that I've been writing about X-Men for, geez, online for like 15 years now. So,
yeah, I remember when I was reading through the book, you mentioned that a lot of the online stuff was at the forums. I had a question. I might be jumping a little bit early here.
Oh, go for it.
Okay.
It's going to just turn into a free-for-all in a couple of minutes anyway.
Okay. Are there still pretty active forums to talk about all the current X-Men stuff on comics resources?
Yes, there's still an active forum there. It's okay. A little bit different in the sense that when CBR was sold, it's not directly connected to the main site, as it were, where mm-hmm. it used to be that every article on the main site would, if you click the comments, it would take you to the message boards. Hmm. So now the message boards are just sort of there. They're being hosted still, but they're like run on their own.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Does anybody else have a question?
Well, I was curious about the forums and how that affects the fan community now, and what kind of, are you still monitoring those discussions? Are you participating in those?
No, I haven't moderated them in a while. Uh-huh. After a while, I think Jonah Weiland, the old owner of CBR, it's kind of weird when I'm writing articles about stuff while also moderating like arguments between people on the mm-hmm. forum. It was mm-hmm. kind of an odd little mix there.
Moderating arguments between comic book fans on the internet must be a soul-crushing endeavor.
Yeah, it just seems fruitless.
Someone on the internet is wrong. I must correct them.
Oh, gee whiz. Yeah, well, good luck with that. Nicole?
Did you have a second part to your question?
I think we'll circle back to it because it has to do with some of the most current X-Men developments.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So I was curious to know what was the most favorite part to write of the book? Like, what did you either learn the most from or just have a really enjoyable experience with? Was there a chapter or character?
What I think is kind of funny about it is so much of it, you write about the stuff long enough, it's almost like the getting new information wasn't even the problem so much as putting it into a form where you think people will actually want to read it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And so I think some of the ones, I think the very first one when they wanted a sample chapter was to see what it would look like. I went for Paul Smith because I just think he's like one of his run. When you start down to write about it, it's amazing how interesting his run on X-Men is.
It's very interesting, yeah, but yeah, he didn't become the rock star that we all thought he was going to be. Why do you suppose that was?
I think it just wasn't something that he really wanted. I'm sorry, everyone probably quote-unquote wants it, but he certainly didn't pursue it the same way like that. I think he would tell you the same thing, that he just a monthly regular gig just wasn't something for him at the time.
Yeah, I could see it as being that thing to be in a high profile book and dreaming of doing that, and then actually having it land in your lap and deal with that that stress and that pressure of making those deadlines. Because I remember when his artwork first appeared, was it first in Marvel Fanfare? Was that when they printed his test stuff? Or was he actually in the book before, drawing the book regularly before that?
And the first time I remember Smith, that's an excellent question. The first time I remember Smith is that Falcon miniseries he did.
Right.
Was that before? Was that after the Marvel?
I was referring to him working on the X-Men.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
yes,
no worries.
Yes, it would be the fanfare. Yes.
Okay, yeah. And that was just eye-popping.
It's because amazing.
I was a huge fan of Michael Golden following Micronauts and a huge fan of John Byrne and Terry Austin. And I just wanted more of that lovely kind of artwork, that detailing. It just became very obvious that his style got looser and looser and, you know, forgive me, less passionate maybe, less inspired. I think inspired was the word. Ben's snickering at me.
Cole's the one here who has opinions about things.
Oh, yeah. You can always tell me I'm wrong. And we can start our own little forum. Anyway, I just totally lost my thread. Thanks, Ben.
I'm sorry. Maybe this will get it back for you. I liked learning that John Byrne, right? He's
correct.
Canadian, and that's one of the reasons why he connected with Wolverine is because Wolverine is Canadian as well. Mm-hmm. Why, am I remembering this correctly, was the cartoon Wolverine Australian?
In the very first...
Pride of the X-Men.
That was Pride of the X-Men, and Brian, can you remind me, that was not produced by Marvel Studios, correct? It was another studio.
No, I believe that was the tail end of Marvel Studios.
Yeah. All right. So, but then who produced the ongoing X-Men animated? Oh, that was Fox.
Right.
Fox Kids.
Fox produced everything. Right.
So the Pride of the X-Men, because we had bootlegs of it. We had VHS bootlegs of it, and we were absolutely fascinated by it. But did they not print it in a graphic novel? Didn't they just take still shots from the tape and turn it into a graphic novel?
They did. They definitely did that.
That is so lazy.
Yeah. And you're right, Ben. The characterizations were great. And then we get to Wolverine.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Random Australian.
Yep.
Well, as one of the producers later mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned this in the book at all, it came down to Australians were hot back then.
All right.
That's literally as simple as it was. Australians are hot. Let's make Wolverine Australian.
Yeah. Mad Max and Road Warrior.
Probably. Yeah. It's an interesting coincidence because Hugh Jackman ended up playing Wolverine, and of course.
That's what you call strange flow.
So, Brian, are you the resident X-Men expert in the office and at parties you go to? Do people bug you about X-Men things?
If they knew to ask, I guess.
Should we not?
Okay. But you've been a comic book scholar for quite some time. As a matter of fact, I read was Superman a Spy years ago, and I want to say that I reviewed it on this show because I'm always looking for scholarly approaches to comic book history for the web series. So the X-Men book is one of several books you've written that go all the way to the rivets in comic book history, correct?
Yes, this is the third one. Yeah,
this is the third one. And what was the other one?
The second one was why does Batman carry shark repellent? And other comic book trivia.
Oh right. Okay. All right. That one I have yet to read, so I'll need to get that
That's
one.
That's great.
That was list of comic history, but it also I had comic creators contribute to it too.
Oh,
Jeff
okay.
Johns, Mark Miller, Dave Gibbons.
Hey, I had a question about some of the current X-Men stuff and how they land for you. So for our market, I'm kind of getting into retailer mode.
Sure.
The X-Men have been kind of a weak franchise.
They have.
And recently, Jean Grey and Wolverine have returned, and they completely landed flat for us. We don't have the dedicated base that we used to have, and I had, like, no pre-orders. How have these stories landed for you and for other fans that you may have talked to?
Well, I think a lot of ways it's difficult for them to get into these stories when the X-Men, for the past, 11, 12 years now,
mm-hmm.
they've gotten nichier and nichier as they go along.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Each of the writers in of their own their own stories, everything made sense, but the collective sum did not match what was happening. It reminds me of, now that I think about it, of all things, the New York Knicks terrible general manager Isaiah Thomas. He would do lots of trades. Each one you could argue he won the trade, but the collective, once he's finished, made no sense.
Hmm.
So each of these stories, in its own sense, the whole going to San Francisco was not a bad story.
Right.
The whole leaving the mansion wasn't a bad story, but it left them in these just bad setups.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that one of the reasons it was an initial success was because it was a niche book with a niche audience that expanded and then imploded?
It's when the 90s, it got as big as it could possibly get, and yet it was sustaining that level for many years.
Well, I'm perfectly happy blaming the 90s for just about everything that's wrong right now. So, yeah, keep going.
Well, no, I'm saying in a pro way, X-Men managed
right.
to keep it managed to stay as Marvel's biggest book well into 02, 03 around there. Yeah, heck, even Astonishing X-Men sold really well.
Right. Yeah, that's the Joss Whedon run is kind of the end of the success for us.
Totally. That cutoff point is amazing. When you bring in Warren Ellis and Simone Bianchi.
Yeah.
Bring them in, good creative team, nowhere near the whole cachet of Joss mm-hmm. Whedon and John Cassidy.
Yeah.
It just that whole just collapsed at that point in Astonishing X-Men. It had been one of Marvel's biggest books. And Warren Ellis is a heck of a writer, just mm-hmm. it was a whole different way. It just did not work.
So, the tonal shift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for your book, do you have it geared towards hardcore fans? Is it something that you think would be good for newbies or in between? Like when you were making it, who was your audience for this book?
I think generally you would say in between. If you're a complete, mm-hmm. if you have no idea about the X-Men at all, you probably wouldn't want to pick up this book.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But if you had seen a movie or watched a cartoon show, that's enough. If you have mm-hmm. any interest, this book will be enough. It's not some difficult read for people to get into. But if you have mm-hmm. no interest in comics, then yeah, it's probably not going to go over.
So this is a good podcast because at least there's people who are supportive of comic books to
right
be
on.
Hearing about
right
this.
Well, and I have personally struggled with a love-hate of the X-Men for about 20 years because I grew up reading it through high school and college. And then come the 90s, and okay, I was in graduate school, so I was stressed out a lot. But I just kind of felt like I was bombarded with repetitive stories and this glut of mutant characters and crossovers. And I held on, and this is going to lead me to my question for you that was an actual question and not just Cole babbling.
Oh, you wrote it down. Good.
Yeah,
on you.
I did. I did actually write it down because, you know, babbling.
Don't let me derail your train of thought this time. The fragile train.
But so, oh, crud.
Sorry.
Just read what you
mean. Okay, so Brian, forgive me. I have to go back to the script here because I am terrible at improv. I went to Shakespeare school. All right, so we've established that the X-Men were my favorite team of superheroes, and I started thinning out my reading pile of X-books a couple years ago, and it was actually kind of painful, but I also felt like I need to do this because purging. And I finally had to give up on all the titles following the Secret Wars in 2015. Was that... when Secret Wars was?
2015 yes. Sounds
yep.
right.
Is that right? Okay.
Yep.
And I did, however, enjoy the Bendis stories. What was that? Just all new X-Men where they brought the teens from yep. yes. the past to the present. And there was like 5 or 6 issues in there where I'm like, you know what? This is really charming and I'm really digging this. And then I lost interest. I picked up X-Men Gold, #1, and just was like, meh. So help me out, Brian. I am an old, grumpy, uninspired personality. Is there an X title out there that would sort of help me reignite that love I had when I was, you know, 15 to 19? Is there one that you are excited about?
Well, I mean, I'm waiting. I mean, I do have some current ones, but honestly, I, and I think a lot of other people, are waiting for Marvel whenever they get around to announcing what mm-hmm. their next step is. I have okay. a feeling it's going to be something good. But until we get there, it's that weird waiting point when you can tell that whoever's writing this book next, you can tell that they've been working on it probably for months. Mm-hmm. And yet they haven't told us who it is yet, which is kind of weird.
I loved was it Piscator?
Ed Piscator is doing grand design.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, there you go.
Yeah. And yes. I read those first two. Yeah. And I thought that was marvelous. But
that's
you know
the
what?
Recommendation right there. Yeah.
That was amazing.
I thought it was marvelous, but it was a review of all the things I knew. But I got to tell you, reading your book was like, oh, you know what? I miss these. Some of these people are my old friends and I miss them.
So on that cut, I would say Wolverine Gambit, Rogue Gambit. Sorry, Rogue Gambit, Kelly Thompson. I think she really got the spirit of early 90s Rogue Gambit very well. And I thought that was a really good miniseries.
All right.
Well, I'm certainly not the biggest X-Men scholar. In fact, I'm not really much of a scholar on many comic books. But I did learn a couple things reading your book. I've learned that that Marvel sold off the movie rights to the X-Men, not because of the bankruptcy proceedings, but it was just a terrible business decision.
It sure was.
I was always under the impression that it was just because they needed the cash.
I know, that's logical, because that would make some sense, but no. Nope.
Yeah, no, it's just another terrible business decision. Also, it's another tidbit from your book that I liked was that Len Wein made more money from Lucius Fox's appearance in the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight films than he ever made from Wolverine.
That is wild.
It's amazing.
Man, that is wild.
It's insane.
Poor Len.
Yeah. Jim Starlin, recently, Marvel renegotiated his contract. I mean, he didn't really even have a contract. They gave him a contract, and so he gets paid now for Thanos a decent amount, as he said. I think he said something along that line. Still less than he gets for KG Beast.
Yeah, I just read about that because he showed up in Superman vs. Batman.
He's on TV.
I didn't even realize it was him.
Oh, KG Beast. I was thinking of.
Yeah, he shows up on Arrow. He's on Arrow a lot this year. So yeah.
I've never heard of KG Beast, but is he Russian?
Yes. Good guess, Ben Lawrence.
What a clever name. All right. Before my final question for Brian, do we have any final questions that we want to talk to Brian about?
Final question. Yeah. Where do you land on Cyclops? It's my test with some customers. I have a lot of people come in and they just hate him off the bat. And I'm pro Cyclops.
I'm not anti-Cyclops.
Okay.
I'm not anti-Cyclops. Cyclops has obviously gone through lots of problems. But a lot of that is just the sake of when you have that many different writers writing you, you're going to have some things that just don't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I lied. My second to last question is, who would be your ideal person to record the audiobook for this book?
Ideal person.
Yeah.
I guess Patrick Stewart. Come on.
Oh, of course. There you go.
Yeah.
Charles Xavier.
Say, do you, you know, at one time, X-Men very clearly had an appeal to a niche audience, which was, of course, we didn't refer to them as the LGBTQ community then. We just referred to them as the gay kids. So, and that was very clear to me growing up in the 80s, going to college, that title really spoke to that audience quite successfully. It was probably one of the reasons why I enjoyed it so much. You do a really great job of discussing that expansion, cultural expansion and sensitivity and awareness throughout the book. But then it became mainstream. Do you feel that mutants as a metaphor still hold that resonance, or has it become something else?
I think on a surface level, it probably still does. But you're right. Once you become mainstream, it's difficult for that same that same resonance, probably.
Right.
Yeah. Good question.
Thank you.
They certainly tried. They've tried. I mean, a lot of these writers have tried to go back to that well many times. So,
I guess my last question that I had was, you know, Ben and I are theater kids, and that's kind
theater
of
theater adults at this
well,
point,
but,
sir.
You know, but it's a term of endearment, though, Ben Lawrence.
Stop and calling me a kid.
Okay, we're theater folks.
There you go.
which is how we began collaborating on our web series, and how we are blessed with so much talent because we can rope in all the theater folks into the show.
Who work for favors
and love to collaborate. Yeah. And one of the things that I was struck by in reading the book was recalling how frustrated I was as a younger reader. I don't care so much anymore, sidebar, but as a younger reader, watching the breakdown of a creative relationship that was so successful. And in this case, it would be Claremont and Byrne, and just these egos that get in the way. And my point is that, like, Ben and I, in doing theater, we learn how to sacrifice for the sake of collaboration. We learn how to compromise. And from your experience in working, writing about the comic book industry, has it ever struck you that publishers have ever taken time to teach their artists and writers how to get along, how to collaborate, how to move forward on something?
I think, to a certain extent, there have been instances where editors, some of the best editors in the game, that is almost their niche, is that they're able to soothe and get people to work together. As I think I said in the book, one of the main problems with Byrne and Claremont was the editors kept changing, and each editor, the relationship was slightly different, and whether fair or not, they viewed it as, oh, that editor likes you better. That editor sides with you more than me.
Got it.
I would see the clear problem here, and one of the also clear problems, is that Shooter, clearly Jim Shooter as editor-in-chief, clearly, as long as the sales were doing well, he was okay with Byrne and Claremont ripping on each other constantly.
Mm-hmm. That's too bad.
So, cool. Brian, before we let you go, I got one last thing to talk to you about. I'm glad you mentioned sports analogy early, because the panel here always rolls their eyes whenever I try to bring up baseball. But growing up here in Seattle,
sometimes we throw things at you.
I'm a faithful yet long-suffering Seattle Mariners fan, and I know that you are into big sports urban legends. And I looked at your website, legendsrevealed.com. I was looking for a Mariners one, but couldn't find any. But I want to talk to you about something else. As you probably know, Doc Ellis threw a no-hitter on June 2nd, 1970, against the San Diego Padres. He later claimed that he was on LSD. But sports writers of the era were skeptical. Do you think Doc actually threw a no-hitter on LSD?
Let's see. You know, I'm willing to buy it. I think I did write about it, so I'm willing to buy it. However, I will say that a lot of those stories, and I was just thinking about one Mariner legend I did do, was about the idea there are certain characters out there where people are more willing to agree or not. basically you tell them a story, and no matter how outlandish, they'll accept it.
Right.
And I remember one Mariner legend was about Ricky Henderson joining the Mariners and going to John Olerud and saying, "Man, I play with a guy with a helmet just like that." And he goes, "That was me, Ricky."
That's right. I do remember seeing that on the website.
And it never happened. Not at all. But people just make up those outlandish stories about Ricky Henderson, and people would just believe it, because some of the real stories about Ricky Henderson are just as outlandish. So
right, they are. The framed $1 million check, to say nothing.
Right.
So... I also like the fact that Doc Ellis, if you say his name, last name, first initial is LSD. That's just a neat little tidbit. All right. He is Brian Cronin. His new book, 100 Things X-Men Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, is out now from Triumph Books. Brian, thank you so much for joining
us. Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's move on to Book Report, everybody.
I feel like I should have headphones on. I'm so confused.
All right. Cole Hornaday, let's start with you. What do you want to tell us about?
All right. Well, I would like to talk a little bit about DC's Terrifics number one by there's a bunch of contributors to this, and now I can't find their names.
Jeff Lemire, Ivan Reese,
Something Prado,
Chris
and something
knows it.
Malo. And I will find, because there's like this weird gatefold thing inside, and
right.
I can't find that. Anyway, now bear in mind, this is a new Age of Heroes DC book that follows on the heels of Dark Knight's Metal. So just to clarify, I read nothing of Dark Knight's Metal. I haven't read but maybe a couple of DC books in the last couple of years, and few things ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
But because I kind of got sucked into the pitch on this one, which is, hey, DC's going to do their own version of Fantastic Four. And I really do miss the Fantastic Four, and I've talked about that. But I've also agree with Chris's assessment, and I've said this before a couple of times, that, you know, the book was just kind of tired and it needed a break. And I'm hoping that when it comes back from that break, it will be more inspired than it was before. This book is really fun. And I really liked it, and I want to keep reading it. And that's good, because, you know, even though I didn't get sucked into the Dark Knight's Metal crossover, I picked this up out of curiosity. It's a team comprised of a lot of old favorites from DC Universe, so it's second or third tier characters. There's Metamorpho, Plastic Man, is it Phantom Girl?
It's from the Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah, Phantom, is that Phantom Girl?
Yeah.
From Legion of Superheroes?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
So, and then, of course, led by Mr. Terrific, current Mr. Terrific, who is a character that I've always really, really liked and really enjoyed him when he was in Justice Society, and I'm glad that he's going back into the forefront. But one of the things that I liked about this book the most is that it had just a skosh of nostalgia for me, and it reminded me of Batman and the Outsiders.
Mm.
And Batman and the Outsiders was this preposterous book that came out in the early 80s where Batman said, gave the finger to the Justice League and said, "I'm going to start my own team." And he pulled together all of these kind of second tier, third tier characters. And what? Metamorpho was one of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with that team. And I thoroughly enjoyed that book. And I liked the relationships that were built in that book. And some of those characters are still around to this day. And the Terrifics had that tone. And this is just a really personal thing. Lately, I've been really grumpy about a number of things. And one of the reasons why I'm personally grumpy about things is that I just think that life's not fair. And I will voice this, and people will say to me, "Well, Cole, why do you think life should be fair? No one's obliged to treat you fairly. No one's obliged to treat you with respect." And what does Mr. Terrific have stenciled on the arm of his coat but fair play? And I'm like, I think Mr. Terrific is the hero I need right now. And I actually mean that very sincerely. So I'm going to keep reading this book.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Terrifics number one from DC. Thank you, Cole. Nicole, what do you got for us this week?
Manga.
More manga!
So I found in the previews that there is a volume 6 offered last month for To the Abandoned Sacred Beasts. And so I thought, well, I've got to check this series out for volume 1. And it did not disappoint. I'm pretty interested in it. So it's presented by Maybe, and Maybe is, for whatever reason, comprised of two people. I don't know if they ever tell us their name.
I don't remember seeing it when I read it.
Yeah, it says, hello, maybe here. Despite looking like a single person, we are actually a two-person writer-artist team.
We are Legion.
We are Legion, yeah. So that's something. So to the Abandoned Sacred Beasts is during Civil War time in America, where the North and the South are fighting, obviously, and the North is trying to gain traction. And so what they do is they create these super soldiers called Incarnates, and they pretty much just make kaiju and different various monsters out of humans who volunteer themselves. But once the war is ended, the beasts are just left to kind of roam, and some of them still have their humanity in them, and if they can be good boys and girl monsters, then they can live amongst the people. And if they can't, well, then there's this werewolf named Hank who's going to come and take them out, like not to dinner, but like, you know what I mean? And he himself is an incarnate who can control his powers. Meanwhile, there's a young girl who her father was an incarnate, and she thinks that Hank killed her father, so she's after him. But then she just sort of ends up kind of teaming up with him a little bit, and a lot happens in this first volume. You hit a lot of monsters.
Yeah, it's like five monsters.
Yeah, and you get bits of their story, it's really interesting. There's enough there that has me on a cliffhanger to read volume two. So if you're looking for an interesting manga to jump into, it's got little horror elements to it. It does have a bit of emotional depth to it as well, and then there's just some like weird like kitschy characters in there too. Like there's like a sexy secretary that works with Hank or something like that, because why not? It's manga. So I would recommend to the Abandoned Sacred Beasts volume one, presented by Maybe.
Great. Thanks, Nicole. And finally, Chris Cassell, what do you got for us?
I thought I'd be on topic and read an X-Men book.
Oh, fine.
So this week, The Hunt for Wolverine one-shot came out. Wolverine came back a little while ago already. He's been in, like, the Infinity Countdown. So this is supposed to be them explaining the how. And if you did not read The Death of Wolverine, basically he lost his healing factor and got covered in molten adamantium and was just, like, a frozen bookend for a while.
I read that in Brian's book.
Yep,
he Han Solo'd, right?
He Han Solo'd.
Yeah.
So this is showing
Carbonite.
All right. This is by Charles Soule, who did The Death of Wolverine. And it shows, like, they just left the adamantium-covered corpse in a cabin in the woods in Canada. And a bunch of the Reavers, those guys that come back every couple years that are a bunch of cyborgs, they want to come and pick up the body and sell it on the market and all that, and then the X-Men fight them and blah, 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 blah. It basically shows that the X-Men snuck out Wolverine's body from inside the adamantium. Kitty Pryde just kind of does her magic and gets him out, and then they had a real burial, and then the body is actually missing. So this sets up a four-issue miniseries that are each called The Hunt for Wolverine, and one of them will feature Daredevil and Misty Knight. The other one will feature the new Avengers with Iron Man and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage. One of them will feature the Claw Squad, which is like Sabretooth and Lady Deathstrike. And one of them will feature all the ladies of the X-Men, like Jubilee and Psylocke and Storm. And so this is just a setup book. It's a well-done setup book. It has a little bit of humor in it in some spots. There's a part where Cyclops is basically says, like, we literally put him on a pedestal, and like his corpse is on a pedestal. And he's sassy about it. I think the thing I like the most is the idea that the Reavers, who are a very old group of X-Men villains, if they can't afford to replace body parts, they look like a bunch of rusty old cars and junk heaps, and they've been failing their jobs for a while, so they're just like, they really suck right now. So it's a good single issue kickstart. I'm not crazy about there being four separate series that you have to follow if you want to know where Wolverine is. But at least the first part was well done.
I have a question about the Reavers.
Yes.
In Joss Whedon's TV show Firefly, the main baddies were called Reavers.
Right.
Did he just steal the name?
No, I've heard that name plenty of times. It's not that inventive a name.
But they're not that different in their conception, though. The Reavers in Firefly are pathological raiders, and so are the Reavers in because didn't they meet them originally in like the outback when they were in the siege perilous? Yeah. They were living in the outback and there was a siege perilous. And
the idea I always liked was that they were the all of the Hellfire Club henchmen that Wolverine sliced the ribbons.
Yeah.
And in the book that we were just talking about, it was basically Jim Shooter was like, well, you can't have him kill everybody. So these are just all the guys who lost body parts to Wolverine.
Right.
And they replaced him with, you know, various
really
cyborgs.
Shot. So like, and he and Brian talked about this in the book, were the Toy Biz action figures, and there was actually at least one Reaver figure that if you hadn't read the comics, you would not know who this character was. Yeah, and he was like a cyborg with a half track body, like, you know, and of course that one sat on the racks and you know got closed out for 50 cents and about 7-8 years later, because if you hadn't read the comic, you wouldn't know who they were. But and that's how I remember the Reavers, that stupid action figure.
That doesn't surprise any of us.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
They're not threatening to me.
The Hunt for Wolverine. Thank you, Chris. Well, that is Book Apart, and that is our show. Coming up is quiz time, but I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comic Extension here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsextension.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcasting.com. Send us an email at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Once again, I want to thank Brian Cronin for joining us today on the show. And now let's get on to quiz time. Get your quiz hats, everybody. It's Cole Hornaday's turn. Lay it on us, Cole.
So in honor of having Brian as a guest on the show, this quiz is going to be devoted to what? X-Men. So we're going to call this X'd Out, a quiz time devoted to those X-Men characters that rose and fell to the wayside because they were hackneyed, ill-conceived, or just too darn silly. Consider that in the 90s, when the X-Men book was peaking, had peaked in popularity, the comic stands were struggling to support an extraordinary onslaught of X-books like The Uncanny X-Men, X-Men, X-Men Unlimited, X-Factor, X-Force, New Mutants, Generation X, Excalibur, Exiles, to name a few. And that was a lot of speed suits to fill, so things had to get supremely extreme. See what they did there?
Yeah.
Yeah, wasn't that terrible? particularly because everyone wanted to create a character to be as badass as Wolverine, and that was just the genesis. And you're dealing with a ton of characters that really kind of sounded like, felt like they were invented by 14-year-old boys. Mm-hmm. So here we go. Ruminate on this. This character's mutant ability was all about his symbiotic relationship to his biochemical digestive system that was comprised of a pair of cyber gastropods, or larvae. Take your pick. This character's creepy satellite tummy buddies could consume anything and give him super strength. Think Matter Eater Lad and that creepy vestigial twin leader of the Rebel Underground in Total Recall. Can you please name that mutant for me?
Maggot.
That's Maggot. The South African mutant created by Scott Lobdell and Joe Madeira first appeared in Uncanny X-Men number 345 in 1997. Next, upon his arrival on the X scene, this somehow youthful amnesiac version of Magneto was not only a master of magnetism, but a master of animal magnetism as well. Demonstrated when he successfully wooed Rogue away from Gambit. True story. Eventually, it was revealed that this youthful doppelganger was actually a clone of Magneto, who ultimately ends up reversing polarity when the evil mutant Astra, his creator, implants him with memories of the original Magneto, leading him to establish his own clone version of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. And can you just please tell me who this mutant was?
Joseph.
That's right, that was Joseph. It was created by Scott Lobdell and Roger Cruz and first appeared in X-Men number 327 in 1995. This triple X mutant hailed from the Nevada mutant brothel known as the X Ranch. Let that soak in for half a second. And she had the ability to exude pheromones, which she could control to stimulate bodily sensations and functions such as causing orgasms or vomiting. Her mutation also manifested on her skin as patterned snake scales that she shed on occasion. Forbidden Fruit, anyone? Please. What is the name of this mutant?
She's from the Joe Casey run of Uncanny. Uh-huh. I can't remember.
And then you can't understand why skin. I don't care for Joe Casey.
I can't remember her name.
Her name was Stacy X or X Stacy.
Right.
Ooh. Yeah. They worked hard on that one.
Yeah.
Really
she was
did.
Created by Joe Casey and Tom Raimi, and first appeared in Uncanny X-Men number 399 in 2001. And here we go, an alternate reality byproduct of the Age of Apocalypse crossover series. This character is the progeny of his dimensions, Scott Summers and Jean Grey, by way of a genetic tampering on the part of Mr. Sinister. Now, following the post-apocalyptic reconciliation of the Marvel Universe, this character landed his own series. Essentially, being essentially Cable since the signature Technovirus, this character just couldn't compete with his parallel reality counterpart because grim and gritty and giant hand cannons and stoicism are just far cooler than telekinetic powers to rival Phoenix. Who was this mutant?
Nate Gray.
Nate Gray or X-Man. Yeah. It's created by Jeff Lebb and Steve... How do you spell it? Is it Scroce or Scroce?
Scroce is what Scroce, I always thought.
Like groceries?
Sure.
Okay. Scroce. And first appeared in X-Man number one in 1995. Now, for being such a purportedly lame character, the X-Men series actually ran 75 issues, concluding in May of 2001. So, hot stuff. Lastly, this character was so totally badass and anti-authority, he wore his baseball cap backwards to hold his multiple rat tails in place, and I think he had like seven of them. A daring assassin of fashion, he also sported a belt of epaulets, bristling with retractable cybernetic throwing blades, and his actual mutant power, because mutant power is in there somewhere, was the ability to ignite the electrolytes in people's blood. Sorry, gotta collect myself here. Oh, and his own blood was acid. He did everyone a favor when he refused to join the X-Men. Can you name that mutant?
Is it Extreme?
Extreme!
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to be confused with Extreme X-Men.
Yeah.
The series, also known as Adam X. This character was created by Fabian Nicieza and Tony Daniel and first appeared in X-Force Annual number 2 in 1993, and that is quiz time. Thank you so much for indulging me on that. I think I've been waiting 20 years to do that.
All right. That's great. Thank you, Cole. And thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.